From Arizona to New York, California to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, is it a border crisis or a voter registration opportunity? Republicans and the left look at the situation on the U.S.-Mexican border differently. Ken Cuccinelli from the Election Transparency Initiative is here to discuss. It looks like there is going to be a Republican leadership shakeup in the U.S. House of Representatives. Could Liz Cheney be on her way out? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Biden administration is attempting to revive a failed Obama-era occupational licensing scheme for tax preparers. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Dan Albin of the Institute for Justice. And Senator Tim Scott offered the Republican response to President Biden's address to Congress. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says Scott rose above partisan bickering over race. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Making elections accessible and free of fraud is the goal of the Election Transparency Project, co-sponsored by the Susan B. Anthony List and the American Principles Project. Ken Cuccinelli served as Attorney General in Virginia and more recently as Acting Deputy Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security in the Trump administration. He is here to discuss the impact of illegal immigration on elections. Ken, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ken, the border crisis has gotten worse and worse under the Biden administration, and a lot of folks are asking, why would the administration put up with all the problems that this surge of so-called refugees is causing? Tell us a little bit about why this is happening.
If you look at the border, you and I see a crisis. It's an invasion. It's a humanitarian crisis. It's a problem on many levels. And you might reasonably ask yourself, why are they letting this continue to happen? Because literally, as you and I speak here, we're in the beginning of May, and this administration, after 3.5 months of the Biden effect, as I like to call it, of these incredible numbers of illegal crossings, hasn't taken a single step to slow the flow. Not one single step, which is amazing. Because all of our facilities are just swamped anywhere near the border. Our manpower is swamped. This is a real problem. So why would they let this continue like this? And there are two basic reasons. One is they don't have the courage to face off with their own left-wing base to slow it down. And they know what to do. The problem is we did all those things in the Trump administration. So anything they might do now to slow the flow, they will legitimately be accused of using Trump's policies, which will be correct. What we did in the Trump administration wasn't rocket science so much as just hard work, and it took political will to do it. So there's not a lot new under the sun there. So that's reason one. Reason two is this is intentional. They not only won't call it a crisis, they don't see it as a crisis. So let's step back from immigration and look at what else they're doing. In the House of Representatives, they put through not one, but two amnesty bills already passed out over to the Senate. They put out a voting bill that will have the effect of sweeping many of these illegal aliens onto our voter rolls, including ones who are already here. So we're literally talking about getting millions of non-citizens pushed onto our voter rolls. And your listeners might reasonably ask, well, how could that possibly happen? Citizens can't vote, which is what the other side says. Well, we didn't say citizens could vote. True, but they took away the penalties if they do vote because they get registered automatically. They get registered automatically because the new federal law, if it's passed, would require states to put all of the adult individuals is the word. It doesn't say citizens. It says individuals in their state databases, including your DMV that might give identifications or driver's licenses to illegal aliens or non-citizens, to your public health authorities that are vaccinating everyone, anyone and everyone. and should be. That's how public health is achieved and so forth. So, and your schools and so on. So these folks would be ordered to be swept into the state's voter rolls. And once they are already on the voter rolls, it is, as a practical matter, nearly impossible to stop large-scale illegal voting. And I know that as a former attorney general and a state legislator. It's why election challenges, and by that I mean the challenges of carrying off a safe, secure, accurate election, are so important to deal with on the front end, because it's nearly impossible to fix fraudulent ballots once they've gone into the ballot box. Nearly impossible. And so when you see that crisis at the border, you see a crisis. They see a voter registration line.
And of course, election integrity is a big issue. It's something that many people in the country remain concerned about, especially in the wake of last year's presidential election. So now, Ken, the Susan B. Anthony List and the American Principles Project have teamed up for something called the Election Transparency Initiative, of which you are now the chairman. Tell us what the Election Transparency Initiative is and what you're hoping to achieve.
It is a joint project, as you noted, of the Susan B. Anthony List and the American Principles Project, pro-life and socially conservative organizations, because we realize that free and fair elections are not something that can be taken for granted, especially at the moment when some on the extreme left are trying to kick them wide open to fraud. And at the same time, we believe that we make our case and win, take it for life, for instance, in a free and fair environment. We are not afraid to compete in the marketplace of ideas. We've been doing very well there for decades. If you think about how pro-abortion forces advance their cause, it is usually or often in courts, the least democratic, little d, democratic institution in our system of government, where the people are least represented. So our goal in our election transparency initiative is to make voting as easy as plausible, but hard to cheat. Easy to vote, hard to cheat. That's our mantra. At the federal level, that means stopping H.R. 1 or S.1, the federal legislation that would be a complete takeover of state elections for the first time in the 230-plus years since our Constitution went into effect, and that would get rid of things like voter ID. It literally makes voter ID illegal. And I got to say that again because it's so hard to believe. It makes the federal proposed federal election bill, H.R. 1 or S.1, one's the House version, one's the Senate version, would make states requiring voter identification illegal. The only thing you can demand of a voter is that they sign their name, but they also mandate same-day voter registration. They're literally trying to push through changes that make cheating ridiculously easy. And that is exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do at the Election Transparency Initiative, and we're going to continue pushing in this direction. At the federal level, we're playing defense to stop H.R. 1. In the states, we have been successfully on offense to try to get election reforms to make elections freer, fairer, more secure, and obviously so that people can have confidence in the outcome of their elections, because that's important too.
We have been talking with Ken Cuccinelli, former Virginia Attorney General, former Acting Deputy Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security under President Trump. He's now chair of the Election Transparency Initiative, fighting for free, fair, and fraud-free elections. Ken, as always, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He does keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Washington for us, and there is much activity there. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Unusual for this time of the year, but a bit of a leadership battle is brewing within the Republican conference in the U.S. House of Representatives. Want to give us some background on that, Scott?
So I think the listeners remember earlier this February when Liz Cheney was facing consternation from a lot of the House conservatives for her vote over impeaching President Donald Trump for the second time. And Liz Cheney, the number three Republican in the House Republican Conference, is the conference chair, and so she largely leads the messaging operation for the House Republicans in that leadership role. Her vote on impeachment was largely viewed as a vote of conscience, and she was overwhelmingly reelected to that position when they forced the vote in the special conference last February. However, in the interim period, she's continued to be off message from the rest of the House Republicans and continues to ignore the America First agenda that many of them want to rally around. And so it's all faced a head point because House Republicans gathered last week for their GOP retreat, and ultimately there was a big, big discussion and pushback from a lot of the members that were sick and tired of her antics and not being on the same page with everybody else.
Looking ahead then, when is this likely to come to a decision point? Is this something that's likely going to happen in the near term, or does it wait to the regular leadership election cycle?
No, it's going to be happening in the near term. Here's what's happened this week. We've had House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy say that he's sick and tired of standing up for her and that he's not going to do it anymore. He's come out in support of Elise Stefanik from New York. Same thing with the House Minority Whip, Steve Scalise. He's supporting Elise Stefanik. And Jim Jordan, Chairman Emeritus of the House Freedom Caucus, has also come out in favor of Stefanik. And that's largely because of her role in defending Donald Trump during the impeachment inquiry the first time. Additionally, President Trump put out a statement saying that he would support Stefanik. But when you look into Elise Stefanik's actual record, she is not a reflective representative of the House Republican Conference. She's not a good spokesperson. She actually is a liberal with a 35% lifetime rating on the Club for Growth Foundation scorecard, which is fourth worst in the House GOP. We're talking about a New York Republican that opposed Donald Trump's largest legislative achievement in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And we think that if House Republicans want to find a new person to lead messaging and win back the House majority, that it should be a conservative. It should not be Liz Cheney, and it should not be Elise Stefanik. That being said, the books appear to be cooked right now, and we're expecting a new vote next week.
Any chance that a conservative might emerge between now and then?
Well, they say there's always a chance in politics. I'd say that it's less than a 5% chance. It does seem like Stefanik has overwhelming support from the House leadership and from Trump and from a leading conservative in Jim Jordan. But I can tell you, in my own conversations with some House conservatives, they are really concerned about elevating somebody with such a liberal record to the number three ranking position in the House Republican Conference.
Well, this is deeply concerning here, Scott, because Democrats appear to be united in jamming through an ultra-left-wing socialist agenda. Is it not important for Republicans to sort of get their act together in order to try to stop the worst of this from happening?
Yeah, I think that most of the House Republicans are united when it comes to voting this session while we're in the minority and trying to win back the House majority. The real issue here has been messaging, but who do you think can lead the message of the House Republicans? Is it somebody that has such a liberal record like Elise Stefanik? Club for Growth actually does not think that that would be the case. We think she would be a terrible messenger given her support for radical environmental climate change policies, her opposition to tax cuts, her support for elements of Obamacare. And behind closed doors, she has been a thorn in the House conservative side when it comes to leading the Tuesday group and the problem solvers in a lot of their bipartisan negotiations.
Turning now to some political developments, last week we talked about a special congressional election in Texas brought about by the unfortunate and untimely death of a Republican congressman. His wife, Susan Wright, was on the ballot in a special election, I guess, primary. What happened there?
What we saw this week was two Republicans actually make the runoff election. And there was a Democrat, Gina Lynn Sanchez, and she fell roughly 350 votes short of making the runoff. And so the second Republican is, again, somebody that the Club for Growth opposes. His name is Jake Elzey. And Susan Wright is still supported and endorsed by President Donald Trump. It was a very, very good turnout for Susan Wright in finishing first place. She took first place by about 4,200 votes. and with 19.2% of the vote. Jake Elsey had 13.8%. Jaina Lynn Sanchez had 13.4%. And another Republican had 10.8%. So if anything, this is a strong reflection of what should be a tight race, excluding a Democrat from making the runoff. This is a race that Ron Wright only won by a few percent back in the November election. And so we're excited about the opportunity that Susan Wright has in front of her. The Club for Growth Action and the Club for Growth PAC are engaged in this race, and we're still waiting for them to determine the exact runoff date, but we should expect that probably in about 6 weeks.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in this idea of economic freedom. If your listeners want to learn more, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
A failed Obama-era occupational licensure scheme may make a comeback under the Biden administration. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine turns to Dan Albin from the Institute for Justice for details.
Buried inside the American Families Plan is an idea to effectively apply occupational licensing rules to the people that help you with your taxes. And it's one of those things, like many occupational licensing rules, that ultimately mean consumers will pay more and probably have fewer choices for who they go to navigate the ever-increasingly complexity of the federal tax code. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Albin. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about the many, many problems with this idea, just one sort of niche aspect of the American Families Plan. Dan, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Let me start, I guess, with the way the Treasury Department is proposing and the White House is proposing this plan. They say that taxpayers often make use of these unregulated tax preparers who lack the ability to provide accurate assistance, and that these people make costly mistakes that end up hurting consumers, Dan. The White House is just looking out for the average American here, right?
Not exactly. And the characterization of tax preparers as unregulated is completely specious. The tax preparers are already regulated by dozens of federal laws that impose civil and criminal penalties, fines of up to $100,000, prison, injunctions, and some of those are laws that apply specifically to paid tax preparers, including increasing due diligence obligations if they're preparing a return with an earned income tax credit. So these are not unregulated preparers. And they aren't even unregistered preparers. All tax preparers have to register with the IRS to obtain a thing called a P-10, which is essentially an identifying number that identifies every tax preparer. And any preparer that files more than 10 returns has to obtain an EFIN, an e-filing identification number that requires that they pass a suitability check. So they already go through several levels of registration that looks at whether they have suitability, including a criminal background check and various other things, and they're already governed by a number of laws that make it illegal to commit tax fraud or to defraud your clients. So these are not unregulated preparers, and the suggestion by Treasury that they are is completely false. They also don't have a higher error rate than other preparers, as far as we know. Treasury has not publicized any studies suggesting that that's the case. And in fact, the National Taxpayer Advocate, Nina Olson, admitted in a 2013 paper that basically every tax return has errors in it. And that's because the tax code is extremely complex, and you can make some underlying errors while preparing the return that ultimately often don't have any effect on the ultimate underlying number that someone owes for their taxes.
This is not a new idea. This is actually sort of resurrecting an idea that was briefly implemented during the Obama administration, then defeated in court. Dan, I'm glad we have you here to talk about this because you were instrumental, actually, in defeating it in court several years ago. This is different because this would be, I guess, Biden, rather, is asking Congress to pass this into law, and that was the big problem last time, right?
That's right. Back about a decade ago, the IRS tried to do this unilaterally without any statutory authorization. And since we challenged that, got it struck down in the D.C. Circuit, the IRS and Treasury and various advocacy groups have been pushing to give IRS the statutory authority to do this. Of course, among those lobbying most for it are the big tax prep firms, including H&R Block and others, who stand to benefit the most by consolidating the market, pushing out independent preparers, and that, you know, gives them a chance to raise their prices, because with fewer preparers in the market, they can command a higher price, And obviously that benefits the big tax prep firms at the expense of the small mom-and-pop preparers.
We're talking with Dan Albin. He's a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice, talking about this proposal just sort of buried deep inside the American Families Plan that President Joe Biden has proposed that would effectively apply occupational licensing rules to people who prepare taxes. Dan, just a minute or so left here. I want to sort of hammer that point that you were just making, which is that this is something that, you know, the big tax preparing firms out there, the H&R Blocks, the TurboTaxes, whatever, they can more easily absorb these additional regulatory costs, right? And that's, I mean, this is the same story we see with occupational licensing of everything from hair braiders to mechanics to whatever you have.
Yeah, that's right. And President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors recognized this in a report they issued about 6 years ago that found that in the vast majority of cases, these occupational licenses just serve to drive up prices for consumers, drive out competition, and benefit the political insiders that lobby for them. And that's exactly what's happened with these tax preparer licensing regulations. They've been lobbied for by groups from the AICPA, the Association of CPAs, to the H&R Block. And the whole purpose behind them is to limit competition so that these organizations can have a larger market share and drive up prices. And of course, that's wrong. It not only makes things worse for consumers, but it pushes a whole bunch of people out of productive jobs that they would have otherwise had. There were hundreds of thousands of preparers making a living who don't have licenses as CPAs or as tax attorneys or as enrolled agents. And if their customers are happy with their performance, they should be able to continue doing so.
Yeah, it seems like it's like we're going to make the tax code more complex, which is something Biden wants to do. And then they're going to use that increased complexity. Oh, there's more tax credits. There's more things in here to justify like even more regulations on the people who actually help everyday Americans navigate that tax code. I don't know. I would rather just see the tax code be simplified. I guess that's probably too much to ask at this point. But that's a whole nother conversation. And we are unfortunately out of time for today. Dan Albin from the Institute for Justice. Thanks for taking some time with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
And again, that is Dan Albin, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. You can check out his work at IJ.org and all the rest of the really fantastic cases that IJ is involved in, fighting for economic liberty, personal liberty, all of that all over the country. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check us out online at Reason.com, and you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Senator Tim Scott's Republican response to President Joe Biden's address to Congress prompted a wave of racially tinged hate from the left. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Racial reconciliation remains America's largest category of unfinished moral business, but too often it has been subverted to and corrupted by partisan objectives. The early days of national reconstruction after the Civil War showed great promise, but it wasn't long before that promise was dashed by President Andrew Johnson. You'll remember that Johnson acceded to the presidency after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. Partisanship at that time was what prevented the needed national healing, but the partisanship was a bit different than today's partisanship. Nearly everyone knows that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, but very few know that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's vice president, was a Democrat. He was a pro-Union Democrat senator, selected by President Lincoln as his running mate in 1864, replacing Hannibal Hamlin from Maine, Lincoln's largely forgotten first vice president. Lincoln selected Tennessee's then-Senator Johnson as an attempt at national unity, since Johnson was the only sitting United States senator from a Confederate state who did not resign his seat when the Confederacy was formed. Lincoln was in favor of the national reconstruction that produced about 2,000 African Americans elected to public office in the years immediately following the end of the Civil War, including a dozen black Republican members of the U.S. Congress. Johnson's perversion of this hopeful vision of racial reconciliation was based on white supremacy, while Lincoln's was based on the recognition of racial equality. You may remember Lincoln's support for the only workable proposal for reparations to former slaves, the so-called 40 Acres and a Mule Plan. Johnson explicitly reversed and annulled that proclamation by what we now call an executive order. So, in summary, a Republican president freed the slaves, held the Union together, supported racial equality, supported a workable reparations plan, and sought peaceful national reconstruction and healing, while the Democrat who succeeded him as president was a white supremacist who vetoed congressional bills granting rights to former slaves. Congress overrode those vetoes and subsequently impeached Johnson, but the moment in history that had offered the promise of timely post-war racial reconciliation was lost. I mention all of this because much of it is unknown by the average citizen today. Racial reconciliation continues to be subverted to partisanship, although the parties themselves have to some extent reversed roles. Just as the anti-communist Nixon could credibly reach out to China when the second President Johnson could not, I want to posit for your consideration that only a Republican can lead effective racial reconciliation today. Democratic Party rhetoric about reconciliation is self-servingly political, which undermines its sincerity and moral credibility. Democrats are vicious when a minority Republican who looks like a leader appears on the scene, and one indeed stepped onto the national stage last week when South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott offered the official Republican response to President Biden's speech to a joint session of Congress. I encourage all listeners to American Radio Journal to watch or read Senator Scott's speech in full. It is one of the best examples of moral clarity in modern American politics. It begins with these words. "I won't waste your time tonight with finger-pointing or partisan bickering. You can get that on TV anytime you want. I want to have an honest conversation about common sense and common ground, about this feeling that our nation is sliding off its shared foundation and how we move forward together." That's an appeal to unity, an appeal to return to the principles on which our nation was founded, first expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Much like Frederick Douglass, Senator Scott did not attempt to appeal to a binary us versus them, red versus blue, Republican versus Democrat choice, but rather he appealed to our shared ideals. That's the only basis from which national healing can occur, a reaffirmation of those ideals that we share in common. A similar appeal was made by then-Illinois State Senator Barack Obama in 2004. His speech to the Democratic National Convention, more than anything else, launched a national political career that brought him to the U.S. Senate and the presidency. Tim Scott's speech last week was of a similar quality, and Democrats and their sycophants in the media know it. They have attempted to vilify or ignore Senator Scott in the days since. One of the most virulent forms of racism in America today is directed against minorities who express conservative views. The hateful use of racist slurs, like calling Scott Uncle Tim, are a perfect example, and the lack of moral outrage from the major media when racism is directed at a conservative black man is telling. They are hypocrites, and Senator Scott stands above them. May he continue to rise as a national leader. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WQST-AM in Forest, Mississippi, KLWD-FM in Gillette, Wyoming, along with KWCF-FM in Sheridan, Wyoming. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.